Okay, just to reiterate what we're going to be doing today, we're sort of doing the class broken down about three sections. The first thing is everybody should have handed back to them their short papers that they handed in about the little film analysis. If you're not here today, you can pick it up from the front desk from Bridget anytime you want. And there's a series of comments on it, and everybody's looking at them right now, just to give you a sense about what was good, what worked, what was exciting, that sort of thing. What I want to do now is actually segue some of that conversation into talking about a handout I have for you about what are some good things to think about when writing about film. Tips that are useful, and useful beyond writing about film, but writing about a text in some particular way. Thanks, Shelley. So I'm going to have a short little exercise where we go through this sort of stuff systematically, and please ask loads of questions. I do this in the service of it will make writing the final paper easier for you and more fun for you, and vice versa for me to read it as well, too, which is to say that going over sometimes, and some of it's going to be redundant to some of you who've written about film and literature before, but for those who haven't, like, you know, listen closely because it'll be very helpful. I mean, at the level of like cutting out hours and hours of sort of like work. In fact, what I've done for you is provided a checklist for you so that when you have to do your final paper, have I done these things? Just kind of go through and check and see is what it's about. So we're going to do that, and the reason of doing that, handing back the papers today, having that little lecture on how to write about film, is that the next thing I'm going to do is hand out the final topics for the second paper so everybody can ask questions or talk about them. They're very flexible, as you will find, which is to say there's a lot of wiggle room in there for things to write about. Having said that, I think pairing up the prompts themselves with the instructions about how to write about film, you'll sort of see that, okay, my job is to take these general sort of prompts and try to narrow into something very specific. So when we get to that point, ask questions, please, by all means. Then we're going to jump right into Dead Ringers, because we sort of got a teaser for it last week, and I want to look at least a handful of scenes from it. And then the last thing I'd like to do is to look at a couple of articles that were assigned for this week, in particular ones that talk about what is it to think about bioethics and sort of watching film, and how is that a valuable sort of strategy. And I want to look at a couple of those articles, segueing us towards Talk to Her, in particular next class where we're going to be talking about The Death of Mr. Lazarescu and Talk to Her in combination. In combination, in particular, for the way that these are two films that deal with witnessing, caregiving, being an eyewitness in some way towards a clinical sort of moment, and how that sort of provides in and of itself a kind of bioethical dilemma, one that the characters in the film are enacting and that we, by turn, are enacting by watching the films. So that's the lay of the land for what we're going to do this afternoon. And let's start by just, first of all, does anybody have any questions about the papers you got back? Somebody asked if how much the grade is going to count for, and my response was negligible, would I say? Infinitesimal? Something like that. Yeah, which is to say, like, the point of it wasn't the grade, and don't worry, almost everybody did fantastic on it. It's more so the fact that I wanted the phrase I used was a litmus test to get a sense of how your voice sounds in writing, and also just sort of hear what it is that interests you. It shaded how I phrased the questions for the second paper, and also informed the kinds of things I thought would be helpful for the tips for today to talk about. But any other questions about what you just got back? Okay, great. That means the annotations were pretty self-explanatory. If you want to talk after class, just shoot me an email. That's totally fine. Again, if you aren't in class today and need to pick up your paper, Bridget will have it at the front desk. So let's turn towards this handout that I'm giving out, which will also be available on Blackboard right after class. There you go.
It's two-sided. The front side is by me.
The actual checklist about writing about film that I put together for you all. The flip side, which I'm not going to go through in too much detail with you, is also there for you. It's from a book called A Short Guide to Writing About Film by Timothy Corrigan. Timothy Corrigan is sort of the head of the Cinema Studies Department here at Penn, and this book is actually sort of like the go-to sort of like book for people who want to be Cinema Studies majors, and it's a little sheet he had at the end to say 10 questions to ask yourself about writing about film. Take a look at it if you want. It's some of the questions I think are great, some of them I care less about. Like one of them, 10 most important questions to ask about films is, have footnotes and quotations been double-checed? Like, for me, that goes without saying. And secondly, if I had to think of 10 things that divide you write about film, that one didn't make the cut, as you'll find on the front of the page, because I find that to be sort of silly. So instead, have that as a secondary opinion, so to speak, about some tips about looking at film. But I'd like to go through on the first side, the long size way, the list that I put together, and I'd like to actually go through it systematically point by point. So ask me a question if you have at each particular point. And I have this as a checklist, like I said, for when you're doing your second paper, maybe as you're putting together the thesis, and maybe just as you're about to hit print when you're done. Take a look at this checklist each time and see, am I going in the right direction at the beginning of the paper devising it? And before you hit print, have I made sure that I've done each of these things? And it will help you load. So let me tell you, this little checklist will be helpful, not at the level of just how writing about film, but really writing about the use of text, so to speak. So, what do I have? Let's see here. Do you want to get your paper out of there?
Oh,
yeah. And then take one of these.
Thank
Thank you.
There you go.
Okay, so let's start with the first point on here. It says the director is the author of the film, so invoke his or her name or names as you would a traditional author. Now, it's a minor point, but I mentioned this at the level of sometimes it's hard to tell because there's so many people contributing to the sort of like multitasked sort of collaborative art that is cinema, but we tend to refer to films like Alfred Hitchcock's The Birds and Todd Haynes's Poison and that sort of thing. To that end, the one thing you should know for yourself and maybe want to make a note of is you should refer to that author at the beginning of your paper. If you're talking about a film, make sure you give credence to that. It's just not only standard format, but then throughout the paper, there should also be a reference towards the author. One, it helps improve the agency of your writing, so that it's more in the present tense and it has a more active voice. And it also helps make the writing process easier. We don't just do it because it's a convention. We do it because of the fact that your sentences start to sound familiar when you keep saying, the film does this, or in the film. So sometimes you mix it up by saying, Hitchcock strategically chooses to use blah, blah, blah. By having a person to identify as the author, oh my lord, it helps put in this prose in a more engaging sort of way. So do it. Yeah. You can, or the creator, you know. So probably depends upon what particular detail you're looking for. So I would say if you were doing something like the television show like ER or something, you might say something like you're talking about the setup. Michael Crichton makes a specific point of choosing this metropolitan location, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. At the level of it's an actor or a director, you can choose. And to that end, know that it's not just the director you're giving all the credit to when I say the author. So if you're talking about Tom Hanks's performance in Philadelphia, like, call the guy out. Call him by name. So my point is that film is so collaborative that sometimes we err on the side of not wanting to call out anybody or any obvious name like we would when we're talking about, say, Fall of the House of Usher. We would easily say Edgar Allan Poe. If we were talking about The Year of Magical Thinking, we would say Joan Didion in a heartbeat. Film, we give pause because there's so many authors, but don't. Think about how that works. And we do it not just, as I said, for convention, but holy cow, the writing is easier and it's more engaging for me too. Shelley?
What about the author of a book that's made into a film? What do you do with that?
I think I would take that on a case-by-case point. So if you were talking about The Birds by Hitchcock, you might say something like, the paranoia inherent in the idea of birds attacking was something that Daphne du Maurier, you know, first identified in writing the text. Hitchcock chooses to change this, and along with his screenwriter, so-and-so does blah, blah, blah. You know, think about, my point is, don't be gun-shy about using those names. I'd rather you use them wrong than didn't use them at all, is sort of the point. So think about attribution, is sort of the point. Not just because it's the right thing to do, but stylistically in your prose, it will be better. Number two, cite evidence in support of your points, which is to say, I have here, for example, can be a useful tool. In fact, those two words can be your best friend if you want them to. So that I need you. It's often referred to, like when you had writing classes in undergrad, as the show me, don't just tell me sort of like thing. So give me an insight, but then back it up with something. So within the sentence, it can be something like, there is a fearful panic in the scene, demarcated by the presence of X, Y, and Z, or so on and so forth. So I put that on there so that if you're going to be sort of editing your paper or rereading it, or as you're composing it, or be reminding yourself, am I making sure that I have the details in here that I need to? Number three, be specific in the claim you are making. Yeah. About your film, especially in the thesis statements of the paper and at the chestnut statements in the paragraphs. And the little advice I have here is if you could take the name of your film out of a sentence and replace it with another film and have the exact same meaning or have the sentence still work, you're not being specific enough. Which is to say, there is a panic in the natural order in Hitchcock's The Birds. Well, let me take out Hitchcock's The Birds and let me put in, I don't know, some movie about a hurricane or something. Well, it works there too. Well, I'm probably not being specific enough. How could I be more? I could say there is a panic in the natural avian world that is specific to the birds. Now that's starting to sound more specific. I could probably go even further. It's really important on the thesis statement for your paper. It is awful and egregious if you read the thesis statement in the first couple paragraphs, and that sentence feels like, holy shit, this could describe about half a dozen movies. Or even worse, I think this could describe every contagion film we looked at this semester. That kind of thing. Pause at that sentence for sure. And the other sentences do that the most on are either the first sentences of the paragraphs that you have or the real chestnut sentence that you think you have. Has it really, does it feel like it's case specific? And it's a minor thing. I make the mistake all the time myself. That's why I sort of go back after I write a paper and I sort of am like, oh Lord, this sounds like I could be talking about Pee-wee's Adventure just as well as I could be talking about X, Y, and Z. So to take a moment and do that is a huge thing. All right, next one, number four. Avoid overly broad introductions. So at the beginning of the paper, that would be something like, since the dawn of medicine, or, you know, paranoia has been a part of cinema as long as cinema has been around. You know what I mean? I tend to sort of go like, as the teacher, cross out that sentence, just start with the next one, and 9 times out of 10, sounds just as good, and you didn't lose a damn thing if you started with the next sentence. So avoid the overly broad at the beginning of the paper. At the level of paragraphs, at the beginning of paragraphs, having a paragraph that begins something like, medical films are a complex form of medical representation, is kind of hollow and kind of empty. So try to avoid, the word you quite often get in annotations from instructors at the side is vague, right? So it's in those introductory sentences where it's paramount that it's not. Because I want to feel like I know very clearly, what am I about to read in this paragraph or in this paper specifically? Again, I'm sure this is second half to a lot of you, and you've heard it before, but having it in a list like this in the checklist will be certainly very helpful in doing a second paper. The fifth point, and this is a big one, plot summary should be in the service of your paper, not relaying the entire plot of the film. Tell us as much as we need to have a handle on the film, and then tell us more detail in the specific moments of the film or your thesis, is a typo there. But basically, tell me the chestnut of the plot that I need in hand with which to come to this film, assuming I don't know it that well. That's a good way to imagine how to talk about films when you're writing a paper. Assume someone has a general sense of this film, but needs a reminder, is a good way to put it. So the bird's essentially about this and that in this moment in time, what's going to happen that weekend, and ultimately, where does the source of this avian infection, we might call it, come from? Now, any more detail I provide after that should be strategically on the service of either my thesis or some piece of evidence that I want to look at. So another way to put that would be the next point on here. If you go to great length describing a scene or a detail, provide some analysis or insight to justify why you're lingering on this moment. And this is what several people did in their short papers, and it's not the end of the world. I do it sometimes too, which is to say, there's a particularly interesting scene where the woman comes into the ER and meets with the patient. We see this happen, and this happened, and this happened. Later in the film, and it's and the description is perfect, but it makes one wonder, why did we linger there for a moment? What insight, what kind of particular inventive sort of moment were you trying to share with us in that particular sort of scene or that particular kind of prose? So bear that in mind. And as it says here, the same goes for very lengthy quotations from source material. So for those of you who are in my literature classes, I get this a lot where people may quote shit like a paragraph long quote from a novel or something like that or a story, and then afterwards sort of provide sort of like, and passages like that abound in this novel. And it's sort of like, why did you have me read 17 sentences from this book? Like, dig in there. Show me why you picked it. What's the phrasing in there that's significant? The cinematic equivalent is, if you're going to describe a 5-minute scene to me in detail, well, by God, give me something that comes out of that, not just the description itself. Because quite often, I think the hesitation to do that is that one thinks one has already done that work by just describing the scene. But the purpose of it is not just because you need to, but because you need to give yourself the maximum amount of credit for the work you're doing. I saw many of you do this, where you would describe a scene, the adjectives, the adverbs, the phrasings that you chose that were so savvy, but there wasn't a moment where you actually said, what's happening here, or what I'm reading in this moment is. And I can read in the sophistication of your prose, like, this person is reading all kinds of things in this film and not coming out and saying it, because they've done such a good job of paraphrasing what's happening. So make sure you're doing that, rendering explicit what are the kind of reads you do. Any more questions before I move on? I know I'm sort of racing through this, but let's see here. This is about midway through the page. It is often savvy and useful to allude to other films using similar devices or themes. This can be just a gestural move, but it elevates the sophistication of your prose and scholarship substantially. And then I wrote parenthetically, even more so for other films by the same director or screenwriter or actor, etc. Which is to say, part of the reason in film studies or literary studies or historical studies we cite allusions or references to other examples or other authors isn't just because it's part of convention. there's actually some significant points, which is to say, if you're seeing a camera work that's happening in Dead Ringers and it reminds you of something you've seen in a similar film, say, for example, like The Fly by the same director, then by God, reference it. And it's not just to show, yep, I saw that movie too. It's actually to make you realize that there's a higher degree of savvy and sophistication to the insight that you're doing. And that's why I say it just has to be a gestural move. By sometimes referencing another text, just even ever so slightly, what you are doing in that small moment is showing that the paper you have written is in conversation with other objects and other authors in the world. To just talk about you in that film is great, but it also has the sort of side effect of making it feel like your paper was written in a vacuum. Sort of you locked yourself in a room and watched this movie and said all kinds of great things, and that's great. But just once or twice gesturing towards something else outside of an article you read, a moment, a historical fact, another film, it takes this much time and it elevates your prose about that much. It's funny how that works. So again, this is not just some convention we have in writing. It's actually got a big payoff for it. So think about that too. Place the thesis for your paper out front as early as possible. You'll notice that I not only underlined but bolded this one because it's the one we're all guilty of all the time. And I have here, and use the best, most precise phrasing at this stage too. The idiom I've used here is don't hold your cards too close to your chest. Which is to say, time and time again, we all tend to write in a way that we save our power sentence or insight for later in the paper, which is to say that what you should be doing is sort of leading with that sort of idea. Or as I've written here, the impressiveness of the paper will not be in the revelation of a brilliant idea later, but your ability to prove it. So pull the brilliant idea up front. I can't tell you how many times I've read papers, even my own, where I get about 5 pages in or 3/4 of the way in, and I see that giant great statement that's been almost uttered the whole paper, and I think this is where it should start. This is where it should start. And if you'd actually do this, take it, move it to the front, and then start reading after, you'll see, oh, I kind of just need to tweak ever so slightly all the stuff that came in between, and suddenly that paper goes from here, bam, way up there. And the reason you had it later in the paper is because you felt like, I don't want to play that card just yet, basically. You know, I want to end on something. But it's really true. When it comes to working with textual evidence and history and cinema, literature, sociology, anthropology, what will be impressive is not just the idea, but even more so if you can pull it off and if you can prove it. So think about always bringing that idea as close to the front as you can. Any questions? Okay. The next one, have clear and regular road markers in your paper for easier readability. This is kind of like a standard. They don't have to be obvious. Like, my 6 points will be, and then firstly, secondly, thirdly, although you're welcome to do that, but one should feel as though, as a reader, that there is some way in which I'm being reminded how far along are we in what's being said to us thus far. So that can mean sometimes phrases like, you know, if my first point was to consider the introductory scene of this particular film, I'd now like to turn us towards the penultimate scene, and then finally towards the last one. In the second to last scene, yada, 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 that sort of thing. And they sound like sort of elementary sort of moves sometimes, but they're actually pretty savvy in the sense that it will help the reader have to do less work in figuring, okay, now where am I? But actually be able to that much easier scrutinize what's being said and the ideas. And you too, as you write them as well. Be mindful of the many facets of the cinematic arts. This is a big one. Audio, editing, score, choreography, framing, dialogue, acting style, casting, distribution, lighting, costumes, digital effects, genre, etc. In other words, I wrote, consider more than just the story. So the story is going to be the sort of linchpin thing that probably guides why we're looking at the films we do. But think about how the sophistication with which you read the story or interpret the story is in part made possible by all of these other things that are there. Now, your job is not to describe all these things. The point of the matter is that list could go on for about 20 more pages. But to just know that there's a responsibility on to think about, like, well, what's happening in the scene is really interesting in terms of what the character said, in terms of what happened in the story. But I'm actually noticing it's really supported by the way that it's framed here, or the lighting really seems to reinforce what's being said. Or it's funny that I'm getting a feeling from the story like this, but the score is giving me a feeling like that. Just remind yourself to do that, which is to say, I think a great thing to do at this particular sort of checkpoint is that in sort of looking over your prose for the final paper, just, you know, every page or so, have I taken a moment in this page, not even every paragraph, but in this page, to consider something outside the story? And that, again, can be just gestural. You know, it can be a long description of the character's progression, and then, comma, we see this replicated in the way the score itself matures from a so-and-so tone to a so-and-so tone. That little bit of a difference makes a lot in terms of the the impact. And questions? Yes, Chelsea.
What exactly is framing?
Framing would be, let's look ahead here at this on the screen. Framing would be
if camera work and movement would be, if you could notice that little second there, yeah. The camera was panning across this way. Zoom and shot is how tight or far it is. Framing is what is or is not chosen to be within the frame at a particular moment. So to think about what's just outside the frame, as we've just seen before, what's within it, or what's placed in the center of the frame, or what's on the side of the frame, what's in the foreground versus what's in the background, thinking about that and its composition. A good way to put it to you is this. Framing is the device which speaks to the fact that motion pictures are motion pictures. They're a series of individual pictures. So if you were forced to look at it just a single shot of a film, how is that composed, the composition of it? That's what framing basically is. And sometimes that's why films choose to linger. They don't all move the entire time. They stop. When they stop, they're always framing for us. Framing, therefore, telling us what is vital about what's in the scene and what's significant about what was left out at the same time. So that's what framing is. Anybody else? Questions? Okay, we're almost through this list. Let's see. The second to last is maintain present tense when describing the actions in a film, unless referring to an earlier scene in comparison to a latter one. So we would say something like, you know, Tippi Hedren, you know, dives into the boat and races in it across the water. At this moment, we see her enthusiasm at potentially pulling off a trick, so on and so forth. Notice the present tense. If I would only use the present tense in something, the past tense in something like, or the future tense, if, you know, the excitement she displays in this scene is markedly different than the sorrow she had 20 minutes earlier, but will of course be vilified towards the end of the film when she herself will become another victim of that sort of thing. The scene you have in hand that you're analyzing or talking about, present tense is what you should use. And that's just one of those things where we do it not because of the fact that it's the convention, even if that's what sort of been told in writing classes, it's because your writing is more polished when it's that way, it's more exciting, and it shows that your engagement with the text is actually that much, has more investment, because you're thinking about it as a text that's alive. It's actually happening in the moment here. And what it does for cinema in particular is it better replicates the experience of what it's like to watch the film itself. To put it in the present tense is to almost make me feel like I'm watching it right now. And it sounds like a minor move, but that's why we use present tense when we talk about films. And the last one is sort of one to bear in mind in any paper you write. Any. Avoid the phrases obviously and of course and it goes without saying. These don't give you enough credit and suggest the sentence to follow is a waste of time. And not only this, but 9 times out of 10, when I cross out words obviously, of course, and it goes without saying, 9 times out of 10, you know what follows? The prose is not obvious, not of course, and not goes without saying, you know? But that's one of those almost, it's out of humility as a paper writer that we sometimes do that. And if not humility, we do it out of, just let me err on the side of caution in case, you know, I'm going out of limb or not saying the right thing or someone has said this before. Who cares? Writing a paper is not the place for your humility. It's for you to show off. And that's why things like being in the present tense, using the right examples, foregrounding your best ideas at the beginning, avoiding bad phrases like the one at the end, are small moves where you're not being hubristic, but you're absolutely not even pretending to be humble. Because the job of a paper is to say, this is all the shit I know about what's going on here in this particular film, so to speak. And I want to also be impressed by that, too. So I'm just telling you the generic stylistic ways that are helpful in doing that process. Of course, the ultimate responsibility is yours in saying smart things and doing smart things with the films that we have. But this checklist will hopefully be helpful in, from my end and in terms of the prose itself servicing sort of that end. Anyway, this is not an exhaustive list. It's just what I came up with about 10 minutes before class started. But, you know, it's certainly lessons myself, the ones I tell myself every time I'm writing something, too. Chili, do you have your end up?
You say a word about paragraphs and headings.
About paragraphs and what?
Headings. Subheadings.
Like subheadings within a paper? You know, subheadings are one of those things that even I myself struggle with. They can be very helpful in that road marker sort of way, knowing that, okay, we've now entered section 2 in this paper. So, in fact, I am guilty of not using them as much as I should. You know, I can write a paper that's 35 pages long, and there's like two sections, and then I'm like, this is what we're doing, like, you know, like, help them out a little bit, you know, is sort of the point. So as for titles for subsections, I don't really care. I'm not, I think the more helpful the subtitle is, the better it is, because that's what its job is. The job of a title of a paper, think about it, is to do a couple of things. It's to relay what the subject matter is, it's to engage, pull you into the paper itself, and it's to realize that it's speaking to a subject or a topic that it relates to. So to that end, we do this when we scour indexes and bibliographies. Did the title catch my eye? Did it have keywords that really spoke to what I was interested in? And does it seem like it's in the discipline or the field that speaks to mine? So there's a kind of advertising and a kind of laborious sort of work behind what the title of a paper is supposed to do. Tell me what it's about and engage me to want to read it. Subsections to me are much more about just relaying what's factual. So if you're going to use subsection titles, just be straight up and have them. It can be fun too, but there's less onus on them to have to be fun or what have you. You said paragraphs and subsections.
No, and the paragraphs, what I meant was, you know, the old thing, well, it was 100 years ago, that only one idea per paragraph.
But oh, right.
You write longer paragraphs. Like,
yeah, I think.
Thought about paragraphs.
I think they vary. I think, you know, obviously you should have at least a substantive idea per paragraph, but you could have more than one. You know, I don't really have that much of a preference to it. You know, a lot of those conventions like that, and this is why I go into detail. Whenever I tell people, like, why this you need to do the present tense or cite another text, I always back it up with, this is why we do it in the convention. It's because of blah, blah, blah. There's a lot of things we were all taught that if you really scrutinize why we're supposed to do it that way, you sort of realize that who gives a shit? Like, you know, always use third person, never use first person in a paper. Did you all learn this one too when you were like in high school and shit? Never use the word I or what have you? The logic behind it is that you're more objective and not just writing a personal editorial or what have you. But the truth of the matter is that there probably are flaws in the paper to begin with, if that is what the work you're doing, not the fact that you're using the word I or me or something like that. So I tend to think, use it if you have to. Likewise, there's the whole thing about don't use linking verbs or try not to use I or are. You've heard this too about how the truth of the matter is it is hard to write a paper without that shit. I don't know about you all, but when I took a critical writing class as an undergrad and I learned how to write a paper without using linking verbs or passive constructions, whatever, I did it, but I was like, that took some gymnastics, because it is hard not to use I or is or are or were or that will or that sort of thing. I think the point is to know that you shouldn't be using just those kinds of words, and you should use them sparingly, such that, to be honest with you, sometimes the most powerful verb is or are or were is a linking verb, such that if we were to say, you know, Tippi Hedren lumbers into the attic in the final scene of The Birds only to succumb to a great and overwhelming panic. The avian birds are everywhere. Well, there's just an R there, but shit, it's powerful. You know what I mean? And because it's being used in tandem with other kinds of verbs. So the paragraph thing, to be honest with you, I think if you're paying more attention to the thesis part and evidence and all of that, that whole instruction about paragraph, one paragraph, one idea, it'll take care of itself. So that's what I think. But anyway, don't feel 100% beholden to these. I'm not the expert on everything either, too, but I just tell you that these are, from my experience, the errors I sometimes make and the ones that I saw sort of coming up in the papers that I just read. And they're not even really errors. They're just that thing about, like, I just want to take a red pen and switch a couple words or something, and suddenly the sentence that is this good becomes that good that easily. So anyway, sorry if I've harped a bit on this, but I think it's a useful thing in terms of doing the final paper. Unless anybody has any questions, let's actually turn towards what these topics are so we can look at them. These will also be on Blackboard right after class ends. So,
sure.
Do we need a couple more back here? Okay. So these are the four topics. Like I've mentioned, they're pretty broad, which is to say they're open to a lot of interpretation. And when I say interpretation, listen up closely. I mean specification. Take these topics and take them somewhere specific. Every topic asks you to look at one film from the topic that's at it. That's one way you're going to have to specify. I got to pick one of these movies. The second is, all right, now where am I going to take it? What are the specific moments, the specific things I'm going to say? And the length is listed here, about 10 to 12 pages. If it's 9.5 pages, that is fine. I don't care. Just think of it as 10, give or take, is what we're looking at here. The general instructions are as follows. One, I would like you to use this paper to demonstrate your abilities to, one, scrutinize the parameters and dilemmas of the contagion narrative, which is to say, your paper should not only speak to one of the questions that's being asked, but feel relevant to what we've talked about this semester. Two, read closely. Film is a rich form of textual evidence, and I think the little mini-lecture just now gave you a sense of the ways of what that means to look closely at a rich text. And three, employ secondary theoretical, historiographical, or ethical opinions from other authors in support or in contrast of your nuanced thesis. You should make a note that that also can be other films, too, is what that means, which is to say that moment I asked you to do at least once or twice in the paper where you're saying, you know, I see something like this in an article that we read in class, or something else that we talked about, or another film. And it could be just a gesture, just an aside. You can also choose to linger. You could do something as simple as say, like, I mean, not simple, but something as big as saying, you know, Lisa Cartwright puts forward 3 points in what she considers the essentials of narrative, cinema, and medicine. I'd like to take these 3 points one by one and go through this film. That's a very sort of wedded sort of way of taking a text and a film and putting it together. You're welcome to do that too, you know, or you can just be gestural, I don't care. But at least do a little bit of that is what I'd like. The most important thing is certainly the first 2 points, though. To that end, I'd like to sort of go through these 4 topics that are possible here, and if anybody has any questions, that'd be great, and if not, then hopefully you can linger on them for a bit, and if you have any questions afterwards, you can ask. Just a note, too, the date is listed here as May 8th, but there's also an extension for anybody who wants one for any reason or for whatever amount of time, so that's fine. Number one is on AIDS and queer cinema. In the introduction to his revised edition of The Celluloid Closet, which is a history of homosexuals in Hollywood cinema, Vito Russo states in regards to queer visibility in Hollywood films, quote, "We have cooperated for a very long time in the maintenance of our own invisibility, and now the party is over," end quote. How do you see John Grayson's Zero Patience or Todd Haynes' Poison as directly tackling this question of queer visibility in light of the image of the gay person with AIDS? So this is a paper that's asking to think, how does one of these queer films, given its influence by seropositivity and the HIV/AIDS virus, how does it comment on the representations of queer people themselves in the film? So there's a lot of room there for where you want to go. And your best bet is to be somehow specific. You know what I mean? Specific at the level of saying, you know, I'd like to consider the fact that if there is a burden or a longing on the part of queer persons to want to see heroism in the portrait of the seropositive or queer person, I want to look at moments that look potentially heroic or unheroic in this particular film. And I'm going to particularly look at these particular scenes. That kind of thing. You know, something that gives a specific handle on what you're doing. So again, to reiterate, your job with each of these questions is, one, specify by picking the film you want to talk about, but two, what it is specifically in the film you want to talk about. What's the angle? What's the bend you want to take on the topic? Any questions on that one? All right, number two. Using Alfred Hitchcock's The Birds, Edgar Wright's Shaun of the Dead, Todd Haynes' Horror from Poison, or Haynes' Safe, make a case for how the central tenets of the horror genre are shared with contagion cinema. What narrative, stylistic, historical, and emotional stakes are shared between these genres as employed in one of these films? So this is a topic that just says, what does contagion cinema and horror cinema have in common? And your best bet is to take that someplace so that it's in the service of what your thesis is going to be. So you wouldn't just want to point out they have similar lighting and plots and stakes and paranoia, but maybe why? And why you think that these two genres speak to themselves, either historically or culturally or aesthetically in some way. Three, pathological gaze. Considering some of the principles of Michel Foucault's concept of the clinical gaze, so in this topic, having to use a secondary source that's already told you which one to start with, how do you see contagion cinema challenging the stakes of epidemiological visibility, depending on various forms of the gaze, cinematic, clinical, pathological, psychoanalytic, etc.? Using Todd Haynes' Safe, Tom Kalin's Swoon, or David Cronenberg's Dead Ringers, discuss how and why a film merges cinematic and clinical forms of gazing. So their first job in this paper then, and this is why the question starts this way, would be, let me go back and look at Foucault real quickly and see if I can find a couple choice concepts or words, or even just one that stands out to you, and let that be the sort of like calling card that you use with how you want to read the film you have in front of you and say, well, Foucault talks a lot about the gaze being invasive and what that does in order to render subterranean, sometimes a word that he uses, and what it does. I think I'd like to look at Dead Ringers and think about how does that film portray cinematically and in narrative what it is to go subterranean. And suddenly you're looking at, well, there's the moments where they do the internal gynecological exams, there's the ones where they're doing surgeries on screen, where they have sort of laparoscopic sort of stuff going on. What's being conveyed in those scenes in the way that's happening? And then sort of think about, well, Foucault says that that subterranean gaze has a potential to disempower or to render minute the importance of an individual. Is that what's happening in this movie too, or not? That kind of thing, you know? So that kind of strategy will serve you very well. I think suddenly, too, you're going to find quite systematically how doing 10 pages on that is almost going to write itself. Well, shit, the scenes are sort of coming to me themselves from the topic that I've devised, and let me just look at them and see what they develop into a thesis in the paper. All right, number 4, clinical testimony. How do contagion films that focus on caregivers, healthcare practitioners, or eyewitnesses have the tendency to upstage those afflicted with illness? Using Christy Uy's, I don't know, The Death of Mr. Lazarescu, Pedro Almodovar's Talk to Her, Tamara Jenkins' The Savages, or Steven Soderbergh's recent Contagion, make a detailed case for why and in what ways such a contagion film marginalizes, objectifies, scapegoats, or horrifies the sick subject in the service of our entertainment or catharsis. In other words, what is the way in which looking at the spouse, the caregiver, the clinician, or the eyewitness to a contagion or a sick person who is contagious actually provide an ethical dilemma in its own right for us watching this particular film? And so thinking about a film and thinking about how it exercises that particular dilemma is kind of the point of that topic. And the fifth one is listed here is Design Your Own. This is the one I'm going to be most open to from anybody that wants to talk about writing a final paper topic that's related to something you've written about in the short one. Those, if you've written something in your short paper about a topic and you want to turn that into your final one, consider that approved already. Maybe just, you don't even have to give me a heads up. The fact that you've already sort of written about it, it's why when I wrote down the grades, I wrote down what everybody wrote their first paper about. So if you want to take that and move on to what your second paper is going to be about, just carte blanche, you've got total permission to do that. If you want to devise a topic for the second paper that you haven't written about yet, I'd say consult with me first, just because I want to make sure that you don't end up doing a topic where, like, oh, I wish she'd talk to me, because this is a library of the call number of the Library of Congress. This isn't a topic for a 10-page paper, you know, that kind of big, sort of wide sort of thing. So just make sure you ask me. Yep.
So when you say we can write about the topic of our short paper, you mean the same film that we analyzed or the thematic element?
I would say the same film, but if you think you want to tweak it and do a different aspect of a different film with the same sort of aspect, maybe just throw it by me. I'm sure I will just bounce back the email and be like, you know, but just to double check, that's all. Anybody else? Okay. So if you have any questions, email me. Come by my office whenever you need me, whatever. But hopefully this little sort of triptych we just did of first papers back, thinking about what is it to, in general, think about a cinema paper, and then looking what the second one's had. Those conversations will inform one another, so it's all in the service of your second papers. And as we're talking some more in the next week or two, we'll sort of help you realize that I'm getting a much better sense about what I'm going to write this final paper on. So, okay, great, everybody. So now we are moving to looking at Dead Ringers. Now, this is the point where I will turn down the big light so you can see better. Now, last class I ended by having us look at the opening credits of the film. And maybe I should take us back there really briefly. I told you about a short history of what it is to think about the natural and the preternatural and of monstrosity. What's that? Is it cold now? Okay. It was 78 when we started, and now it's 72. So I went for 74. Okay. Yeah. It's all right. If you want higher, just let me know. It's no problem. So I had us look at the opening credits of the film, and let's see if I can just look at a little bit. So
can I ask something about the beginning of the film?
Yeah.
So it's Toronto, Ontario, 1954.
Mm-hmm.
And then these guys have a British accent, and I don't understand why you place it in Toronto and the whole of the these characters have a British accent.
Well, I can't say with definitive reason for that, except that I know Cronenberg loves to have his film set in Canada because he is Canadian. and that he definitely wanted Jeremy Irons for this part, who's British, and that maybe he felt that asking the man to play sadistic gynecologist and two of them simultaneously was enough, and so he didn't want to put on the Canadian accent at the same time. Maybe, I don't know. The part I don't know about is I told you that Mansell Brothers in this film were actually based on a pair of actual Canadian brothers, and I don't know if they were in some ways born in Britain or something like that, if that might be a biographical detail that the film has preserved. I'm not sure. But I certainly know that what helps streamline it in the service of the plot and why I tend to forgive or forget that they have a British accent is that Jeremy Irons is doing so much throughout the second half or the most of the film that the accent switch I sort of forgive or forget about or something like that. Okay, good question, though. So here's what the opening credits were. It was a series of these... what you call it, history of medicine images. And I mentioned that so many of them are alternating between anatomy and technical instruments at the same time. Cronenberg, I mentioned to you, is a director that I think about as somebody from his films like Videodrome and Fly and Existenz and Dead Ringers, as somebody who is interested in technology, violence, and anatomy or the body and sexuality, one could even say. So how do those three things intervene with one another? The opening of this film and its very sort of visual sort of like arsenal that it's choosing from the history of medicine seems to be doing the same thing. We're alternating between images like this of what we see here are identical twins in utero from probably a 16th century anatomy text to images like this one, which is some, I don't know, like fucked up razor or some shit like that. So some actual medical sort of like tool, so to speak. So we're oscillating. Does anybody know what it is?
It's like a speculum.
Is it? Okay. It is. Oh my God, you know what it is?
It's like a four.
The perspective that's going this way, I didn't get. So instead of like a Gillette, doesn't it? It looks like a Gillette razor, but it's not. There's supposed to be some depth there. Okay. So, but we're alternating then between images of sort of like anatomy and medical technology sort of back and forth. And we know that this is a recurring sort of fascination or obsession on the part of Cronenberg. And it's sort of going to be one of the points of the film, quite literally what the plot's going to act out. These brothers and their interests as clinicians, as gynecologists, and the work that they do, coupled with the fact that now one of them becomes obsessed with these instruments that are going to be a device of how to intervene with what to do with the deformed female sort of anatomy. To that end, what's being set up for us, I mentioned to you, is a specific story with a specific historical background based on two actual sort of twins that lived in Canada. But not only is the story sort of hearkening back towards all of the sort of Cronenbergian canon of the films he has done before and after, but it's thinking about, is this what we do when we think about medical history or medical narratives or medical visuals that interest us? Do they become most fascinating when they frighten or shock us, when they speak to something that's in between what is the comforting and familiar and what is the shocking and unusual? It's what I talked to you about hierarchy of sort of the natural and the supernatural. In between is where the preternatural is, the preternatural where the demigodly, where the monstrous, where the freakish, where the unusual, where the, in some ways, frightening sort of individual might particularly lie. This film, then, in its plot, as I've talked to you about, is about twin gynecologists who become obsessed with a woman. And the woman they become obsessed with is a woman they refer to as a trifurcate or bifurcate? I can't remember. Trifurcate? Trifurcate, which is to say that she has sort of three passages within her sort of reproductive system that marks her, as they say, as a kind of mutant sort of woman, is how they describe. What the film is asking us then is what constitutes mutant in this particular clinical and medical narrative. Is it this woman's body that they've talked about? Is it the fucked up instruments that he makes at the end of the film? Is that the most mutant sort of thing? I mean, it's in some ways the most scary visual we have in the film after the opening credits, you know? Or is it the brothers themselves? These brothers who are identical but not conjoined twins, but the film makes us wonder if they might be conjoined in some other pathological or psychological, if not professional, sort of way. What I want to do is jump to the first scene where we have Claire. This is the French-Canadian actress being examined. Let's see. Okay. And unmute and play.
Well, are all the necessary parts there, Doc?
Yes, they are. And there are a couple of extra ones that shouldn't be.
That's funny.
I wasn't joking.
Oh,
you go. I can't, Bev. I'm late already. If I fuck up with the chairman's wife, we don't get our grant. She's a trificate. I've never seen anything like it. Yeah, I'll be down in a minute. Dr. Mantle. Keep the car waiting, will you? Thanks. Is this Clair Nouveau? Yeah. The Clair Nouveau? Yeah. Ooh. What's she doing here? She's doing a mini-series. She's got three agents and a bodyguard in the waiting room. And her line is empty without children. How did you know? Oh, come on, Bev. Everyone knows that. Don't you ever read the National Enquirer? Stars, life, empty without children. Well, I hope the National Enquirer also explained how we can make a fertile, because I don't think I can. Well, we'll have to see what I can do. Ellie, what about dinner with the chairman's wife? I guess La Bella Contessa will have to wait. Right. Let's take another look. Should be beauty contests for the insides of bodies. You know, best spleen, most perfectly developed kidneys. Why don't we have standards of beauty for the entire human body? Inside and out.
I have a feeling you do.
So I'll tell them to fuck off.
Okay, let's talk about this scene. So at the level of what's supposed to be freakish or monstrous in this film, which is sort of what's up for debate in some ways, what's also sort of frightening? What would you find frightening in this scene? Yeah.
Well, I think the lighting makes it really creepy. Like, I don't know how the doctor's office looks. It's like,
yeah.
Blue and dark.
The lighting is one of the most interesting things about this film, and we'll get to that in a second when they do the surgeries and they're wearing scrubs but they're all red. You know, that kind of thing. Like this very frightening sort of color choice that's happening. But that choice of palette we see even here, in the sense that, yes, there's something fluorescent almost like in the scene, but it feels even odder. I mean, what did you make of the color palette here? Did you think it made you feel what? Icky or?
Yeah, it's like sci-fi or something. Abducted by aliens.
Oh, totally. I mean, this scene is reminiscent of alien abduction scenes, isn't it? In the way that it actually sort of, not just the color scheme that it uses, but the kind of probing that's sort of happening here, too, and the way that one feels that there's a kind of violation that's sort of worked here. I mean, I often think of this scene as that, you know, this scene troubles me because I can't tell if it is a scene of sexual violation or a scene of diagnosis. It's probably both that's sort of happening here, but I think we're uncomfortable by sort of what's happening. I told you, my theory about this film is that one of the things it sets forwards is that of all the things that could be freakish or strange or sort of monstrous or troubling is the male gynecologist, like one of those. Is that one of those ones, especially as we're moving in the 1980s up until now, where more and more of the profession is certainly women, OBGYN dominated. But this film sort of doubles that by having twins that are sort of there in a way that it feels uncomfortable. It's sort of happening. What other emotions did you guys have in watching the scene, or things that you noticed stylistically? Yeah.
The costume, the I guess gown that they wear.
Yeah.
I've never seen a
this blue gown.
Yeah, this weird blue gown. What it reminded me of was like what a medieval inquisitor would wear, or something like that.
Maybe this here, okay. With the white front here?
Yeah, it's like, or like a Ku Klux Klan, like it's like a weird...
Well, Ku Klux Klan is right, because we're going to look at the red scrubs they wear, and I swear to God, you throw a hood on them, and it's the Ku Klux Klan. I mean, it looks like that sort of like Grand Wizard sort of thing. And there's, I think, some of that drapery, some of that exaggeration of costuming that's being done here. I mean, and if we think about it, the reason the Klan comes to mind is not just that it looks like the same kind of design, but what's the function of that kind of a wardrobe in the Klan? Anonymity, theatricality, exaggeration, a sense of importance that's probably not equal to what it actually is, a feeling of like magisterial authority, if you will, in some degree, that truthfully is incongruous to the work that's sort of happening there, and an attempt to render aesthetically intimidating in the face of what we know is morally offensive about what's happening in the case of a Klan or something like that. And I think that's what's happening with these brothers a little bit too. Their choice of Scrubs is ostentatious, it's stylistic, it's heavy-handed, but in some ways, does it exacerbate or does it cover up the discomfort that we sometimes have around them in some way? And I certainly think that the exaggerated, overdone, overwrought sort of intentional flair to their Scrubs or their clothes is part of what the film is sort of doing in its stylized and yet troubling sort of way. So what the costumes are doing, the film is sort of doing as well. Shelley?
And I didn't remember as much that they duped her even at this point. And it seemed just like, I just thought of how professionally disgusting this is, because, you know, can you imagine your doctor, like, changes into somebody else, comes in and leaves you. Oh, you've got a few too many parts, Bob.
And
this one's pretty tough. She can hold her own, but still, I see the anxiety in her.
I mean, it's interesting. We often refer to films, and when people pitch films, you should know this. When you pitch films at a studio, you tend to say things like, it's Lord of the Rings meets Pretty Woman. Like, that's one of the things they often do, like trying to think of two films to throw together. But they also say, here's how it breaks down. Act one, so-and-so-and-so. Act two, this is what happens. And act three, and each act has its own sort of stake. The film tends to quite often follow a three-act structure. In Den Ringer's act one, the entire plot is, and it's about 30 minutes or 45, the first act is, they are twins and she doesn't know it, is basically what the first third of the film is about. So we have that scene in the restaurant where that woman who she's eating with, that like rich bitch, and she's like, they're twins, you didn't know that? Like that sort of thing. And we know that, and thus act one has sort of ended, so to speak. And then act two is the relationship that one of the brothers develops with this woman, then descending to drug addiction and his own sort of hysterical sort of psychosis. And the third act is how do we resolve what has probably been the lifelong tension between these two brothers, which is, can they ever fully meld into one? They have tried to do it in the profession that they are doing. They have tried to do it when they were children and doing everything together. They did it at school. They've done it in life by replacing one another when they have to give a talk or see a patient or do what have you. And so at the end of they did it sexual counters where they have sex with the woman and sort of take turns with the same person in a way that one person experiences what the other does. The end of the film is like, how can we make this literal or not, so to speak? So that question of the duping that's happening here at the beginning is also what's creepy in this scene. If it's the lighting and it's the wardrobe and it's the exam that's happening that feels a bit forced, it's also the deception that we know that's happening in this scene is also a big part of this. It's icky about it. Anything else? How about, what do you make of the, Shelley, go ahead.
Can you imagine if the doctor says to you, that's fantastic, about a gynecologist? I mean, that's just, it's just, you don't want your gynecologist to say that.
You would be stumped. But I also love, too, that what's that focus on the fantastic is sort of what happens in the scene just prior, before he examines her, when he says, is this Claire Nouveau? You know, I love that name. I think it's like, very chic, so Claire Nouveau. And he's like, yeah, the one or whatever, the celebrity or what have you, which is to say that what's the thing that's most fascinating here? What's the most exceptional thing in here? Is it the fact that she's a trifurcate, or is it the fact that she's famous? And their fascination with her, each brother, and we're going to find that both brothers end up becoming fascinated with both of those things, is what constitutes the most exceptional thing? Is it anatomy? Is it beauty? Is it inner beauty? Is it celebrity? You know, what is the thing that sort of calls to mind sort of their attraction or their investment in her? And it's why one of the sort of seminal moments that happens in this scene is that invocation of, you've heard of inner beauty, haven't you? And it seems to be a play on not just the, sort of the inner part. Normally that phrase inner beauty refers to the emotional innerness of us. You know, what is it inside of our hearts and our souls and our minds that really is beautiful about us, as opposed to sort of superficially, so to speak. So in that sense, that they're doing an internal exam, and it's a physical one, is sort of the change in what that term inner means. But I think it's also a play on what's beautiful. Is the beautiful thing about a person that they're freakish or they're unusual or they're exceptional? What gathers them worthy of our particular attention, lingering on them, revisiting them as a patient, integrating them into our lives? And it's the stakes that we have in watching this movie. Part of what's troubling about it is we're looking at these sort of sadistic brothers and sort of looking at the weird sex life they have with this woman and seeing the drug addiction they devolve into and seeing the mutant sort of like operations that are at work in this dubious bioethical, unethical sort of medicine or science. And we're finding it interesting and fascinating for the reasons that it's all of those sort of potentially duplicitous sort of things. And so the film is sort of asking us to sort of struggle with the hard part about what we're seeing too, in terms of what's fascinating. What they find interesting in each other, begs the question of, well, what constitutes beautiful and great? Then our watching the film is, that's what we're most comfortable with too, because we're sitting there right along with them, sort of watching what's happening. To that end, I want to skip to a scene that's pretty a good one in terms of the salacious sort of quality. Let's see. This is a good one, too. I'll show this briefly. So this is this brief sex scene that we have with them. I'm not going to linger on it too long, but... So I kind of wanted to stop here for a second. And if I mentioned that Cronenberg seems to be obsessed with the way that technology... sex and violence or industry sort of to be combined. I mean, this is a scene where we have them having sex using medical instruments as part of the way that they're engaging in a sexual act. The lighting is this almost identical to what we had in the clinical sort of fluorescent sort of experience before, and suddenly we see that this relationship and the scenes that are having it are doing this exact collapsing, if you will, of what is worthy of medical attention versus what is worthy of scientific attention versus what is worthy of sexual attention as all being the same thing in this particular film. And the troubling sort of part of looking at that is, you know, what part do we feel uncomfortable, or do we feel actually like salaciously titillated by a scene like this? What do you think is the register that Cronenberg is trying to have us have from the scene? Are we supposed to be like, that's some freaky shit? Or are we supposed to be like, ooh, you know? Or are we, do we linger on this or not? How did you feel?
Like, uncomfortable that it was kind of racy.
Yeah, I mean, it's racy.
And blurring the lines between sexual and medical and his job and his loving. What are those things doing? So what's happening there? Like, so please.
What's happening there?
No,
yeah. Michelle has a long conversation.
Because he takes it off. I thought it was. At first, I thought it was scissors shoved in, but it's actually forceps that are like.
Because
he takes one off afterwards, and it's like rubber tubing.
She's just using medical equipment to like bind her.
Yeah,
It's a bondage scene using ligature
right?
medicine.
Yeah, using
yeah.
It
mm-hmm.
yes.
yeah.
So I didn't know if it was cutting off her circulation or.
hey, who knows? You know, but I mean, I think the point is the fact that what we notice is that the film is at once. Unusual for us to watch. We're not used to seeing sort of doctors sort of binding up their patients like this and having this scene. But also it's reminiscent, I think, cinematographically of what we saw earlier in the examination. So what felt uncomfortable, I think, in the last scene where we saw the brother examining her and duplicitously pretending to be the other brother and her sort of like, oh, when he examines, and us feeling like, is this violation that's sort of happening? This scene, as many bondage scenes do, in particular because this one uses medical instruments, also invokes some of those same discomforting feelings. And yet, we feel as though she's complicit in what's happening in the sexual act here, such that that's what bondage often is. It's somebody playing with that tension of being complicit or involved in a particular sexual act. But it hovers and it lingers in this particular film. So what this scene does is it seems like an exaggeration of something we saw earlier, but I don't know that it's an exaggeration so much as a repackaging of what we saw earlier. Mm-hmm. And to that end, that's what the film is going to continue to do throughout, is package and sort of repackage sort of some of these feelings, these constellations of variables that make us uncomfortable with what's happening in the film. This section of our class is called the grotesque, in the sense that how much does grotesque play into contagion, and if the cinema of contagion has a lot to do with feeling about the safe or unsafe or paranoid or unparanoid sort of zones, almost everything seems potentially grotesque in this film. Are actresses grotesque? Are medical instruments grotesque? Are doctors and gynecologists who are men grotesque? Are people who are trifurcates grotesque? Are drug addicts grotesque? Are the people who enjoy watching them grotesque? Am I grotesque for watching this particular sort of film? And the upping of the ante of these scenes, I think, is an attempt to keep registering and picking at the wound of that discomfort. What I want to turn to is that scene I was talking to you about before, which is one of the most famous ones, with the red scrubs that are used during the surgery. Let's see here. Okay, we're going to look at the scene from beginning to end. It's about a minute long, and then I want to go back and look at the specific components in it. Maybe we can talk about this scene in combination with some of the things I told you about framing and sort of cropping and stuff.
To achieve anything in life, one has to keep life simple. Don't you think? Irrigation. Of course, it would be an exaggeration to say that we can make up a new set of fallopian tubes using just anything that's handy. Those tubes are highly specialized little organs. But with the kind of help we can offer the process, it is possible to modify several other organs. The odd vein, or as today, we're using a femoral lymphatic vessel to take over the function of conveying the egg from the ovary to the uterus.
Okay. So this is, I think, one of the richest scenes in the film, actually, although some of you may have actually almost forgotten it.
To achieve anything in life, one has to keep...
I want to look at how it's sort of broken down.
Don't you think?
So we begin with a look at this microscopic sort of perspective to a television sort of perspective.
Say that we can make up
with the voiceover. Now towards what can only be described as live theater in some particular way, looking through this glass sort of pane. And what we actually see then is a sort of movement towards the inclusion of all three of these different forms of viewing. One of the questions I asked about how different forms of gazing or viewership are combined. In this film, we began with a close-up of the microscopic vision here and moved towards the television sort of perspective here, or the cinematic sort of gaze, if you will, now towards a general, more largely theatrical one, but actually includes all three sort of together in one particular moment. So what is it like to look at something too closely? What is it like to look at it through the lens of cinema or television? What is it like to witness it in theater or performance? And what are the sort of troubling things about seeing that kind of story or narrative appear? Let's start with the visual of the red scrubs. Why is that so... I mean, it is creepy, right? It was actually one of the major images that was used in the trailers for the film when it first came out in the late 80s, was they would show, like, dead ringers, and they would show, like, the guy coming up in the red scrub, so to speak. What's haunting about that image? Yeah.
It's blood red.
Blood red, yeah. Which is to say, in most circumstances, when we would see that much red in a surgery ward, we'd be like, it ain't going well in there, is it? I mean, right? Like, we've got a bleeder, right? Just to say, the reason we have white scrubs quite often, or light-colored ones, is so that blood shows up very easily. So that we know if we've got a bleeder. So that we know that there's something that's going amiss or awry here. That there is no, that these are red themselves, and that potentially they could be blood-stained and we couldn't know it, feels reckless. I think, feels hubristic and ostentatious on the part. If there is an actual practical reason scrubs aren't red, that having them for the red here, whether we realize it or not, discomforts us, not just because it reminds us of blood, but because of the fact that if there even was blood in there, they wouldn't know it. So there's a real sort of like overcompensation on the part of these. And we know that it's there for the same reason, like I mentioned with the Klan thing that you mentioned, which is the theatricality of it is more important than the practicality of it, is what this scene is sort of saying to us subliminally. These doctors care more about how good the show looks than about whether or not they have the standards that are in place to make sure that it feels safe for the patient. Ed.
Yeah, I'm totally off base, but what came to my mind was ritual and religion. And the reason it did was at the very beginning his gown looked like the collar of a priest. And
yeah.
When I saw this, I thought of cardinals, and I thought of ritual, and I thought of religion. And it seemed totally out of place with the scientific.
And that is what wizard robes in the Klan are trying to think to do as well, as add an almost papal degree of like reverence to the. You know what I also think of when I see this? I think of the Imperial Guard in like Star Wars. You know what I'm talking about? The people with the red outfits that were, and those are there likewise to seem almost cardinal-esque and or Klan-esque and or something like that. And all of those imageries I think are bubbling up, and not just the kind of gowns we have here, but their placement in the clinic as they were. So whatever is endowed in a papal or a Klan or in Star Wars Imperial Guard sort of image, to see it in the clinic is to be very troubled by that not normally being there, but also what those values mean inlaid in a technical sort of moment. Yeah?
I thought of the ritual aspect too, but without the religion, it kind of reminded me of the skulls of some sort of secret society type. You know,
like Skull and Bones and that kind of shit?
Yeah.
Well, that's what the Klan thing is, too, I think. I keep harping on that, but it's also this idea of, like, being in a fraternity or being in some sort of, like, select sort of group, if you will. It's also interesting in the sense that what's so hard is that these brothers always seem like a party of two, there is them, and then there is the rest of the world, if you will. And these scenes of the scrubs in red start to feel troubling as well. There's more of them. There's not just two. Yeah.
It also reminds me of what you wear. I mean, not the color red, but in a science lab, where you know when you're dealing with highly contagious stuff, and you gown. You actually do gown.
Yeah, the closest we have, I think probably on the color palette towards this in the clinical realm, is thinking about like the haphazard or the hazard sort of hazmat sort of orange, if you will, to some degree. And therefore that is what's adding probably to some of that feeling of contagion or infection that might be in the film. This feels less like a gynecological moment than maybe it does like an epidemiological one, the degree of color that's sort of there. Red is always known in advertising and art as the color that always pops and stands out and therefore draws us towards something. And the way that it's so explicit and blatant what is uncomfortable in this scene, in that use of red, is also sort of what's troubling, in the sense that a lot of pathological contagion sort of films tend to almost camouflage the way in which that which could be contagious. And so what's scary is that we often can't find it. By God, what creeps us out in this scene is just like glaring at us, if you will. So there's something even bold in the way that visual strategy is happening. Tell me a little bit, though, before we move on, about what do you think of the construction of this scene? The way the camera rests just behind the attendees, which we can assume are probably like investors or something like that in their particular sort of private practice, or people at the hospital, maybe. Then we have a shot of the television camera included in the corner, plus him front and center. There's a slight panning that's happening a little bit to show us that there's another TV on the left-hand side as well. And then with this theatrics sort of happening in the middle. What do you make of that composition? Why do you think the camera is situated where it is and why it's including what it's choosing to include?
It's like we're watching them, they're watching that, and that is what he is seeing. It's kind of like
continuity. Which is to say, the first thing you're saying is that whenever a camera is placed over the shoulder of someone in a film, quite often it gives us the feeling of being there in the location or of almost eavesdropping what's happening. So quite often when you watch a film, there's a private conversation that's happening and then it's a shot, counter shot, over the shoulder included. The over the shoulder included makes it feel like I'm going to reach around you like this. It's like we're sort of doing one of these things, you know, sort of leaning or watching in over, peering, if you will. Whereas if we do a shot, counter shot with two people and don't do over the shoulder, just do, we tend to feel like we're just being privy from the perspective of each party that's there. So in this scene, being over the shoulder gives us a sense that probably that we might be in the audience as well, watching what's happening. We just are in the second row, if you will, of the show that's going on here. But the layering that you talked about, of us seeing him with the camera behind it and the theater behind it as well, is to show not just the echoing of what's sort of happening in the theatricality here, but also in the multi-layered way with which we are visualizing, maybe objectifying, but certainly assessing what's happening in this particular moment. And I think this scene is so rich for me because it renders explicit what is actually multi-layered throughout the rest of the film. We are always looking potentially microscopically and cinematically and clinically and theatrically at what's happening in the story that's being played out. This film just makes it as plain as day that we're doing all of those things in the actual story that's happening in this particular moment. Anybody else? Thoughts on the framing here? Yeah, Chelsea.
I was just going to say something about the theatricality because I actually had this weird reaction when I first saw the scene of the scene in Amadeus with Don Giovanni and like how he's like, there's, I don't know if you like remember, but there's like all these masks and the like sort of Peter Pan collar of it all. I don't know. I thought like, is it some sort of disguise?
I haven't seen it in a long time, but you're reminded of something so theatrical in its content and subject matter as well. It doesn't surprise me in the sense that, I mean, one expects there to be, I don't know, when they're done, a sort of bow at the end or something, and the way this is all very presented and orchestrated in a very specific way.
I can't remember the scene. Is his brother in the... Is one of them in there doing...
One's behind the microscope and one's doing the talking.
Yeah. And it's not the woman, right?
It's a different person, I think. It's a different person. But that also goes to show that we can feel like that interchangeability that's between the two brothers as one performs, and having the same actor Jeremy Irons play this, is that we feel as though we are seeing it performed by a person, and this very person is providing the commentary on us sort of simultaneously. So that kind of duplicity that's sort of there isn't just them pretending to be each other, but we almost feel like, you know, this is him. If it was actually the same person, it would be him watching the film of him doing the surgery, providing the sort of like commentary, like the DVD commentary you have from the director or what have you. It was a long day that day, but here's what we did when we were doing that sort of thing. It appears to be played out of twins. And it's in a way that actually is supposed to render more intimate what's in the mind of this man, made possible by the brother that's doing it and also his partner.
but it's unsettling as well, too. I think one of the interesting things about this scene very much for me is whether there is safety or not, or whether there is some assurance or not that the glass pane that's between these two particular things. We're essentially looking at a shot of two rooms. What's happening in what is supposed to be the sanitary space of the surgical ward, and what is happening in the observation gallery on the other side of it. And because these two men feel almost interchangeable, there is a kind of hovering in this scene for me of penetrability between this glass pane. There is though there is something that is shared across that divide, and therefore, that's what's supposed to happen. We go to the surgical wards or these sorts of things to feel like we're almost in the room, if you will. The brother thing and the connection that's happening, the video camera reinforcing the way, well, there's probably technically then a camera inside and a line running between the two of there actually being a non-sanctified space in this particular moment. So the recklessness that has been endowed in those red scrubs feels similarly reckless to me in the way that there is a kind of impenetrability in the way that it's presented narratively and visually in this particular scene with the glass pane between the two. Yeah, Shelley.
And when you pause it like this, it's even scarier. Like,
yeah.
It was one thing when it was big, but now when you keep looking at it, it becomes even more powerful for me.
Yeah, and I love that the longer you look at it too, there's scary things in here. Like, some of my favorite things are like the giant thing above them that talk about abduction narratives. Yeah. Like, is this where they can like teleport back up to the top or something like that? I love also the microphone that he used. It's only rivaled by the Price is Right microphone, you know what I'm talking about, in terms of its like over-exaggerated like phallicness or too muchness, so to speak. Not to mention that like there's like three people in the room, I think, that are watching this, like, and yet the microphone is there. All the more to sort of master of ceremony sort of effect that's sort of happening here. To that end, this film is in some ways the most explicit in what are the galvanizing sort of feelings and strategies that are used throughout the entire film. So I sort of love it for that reason. But this is a good example if you're thinking about kind of scenes to look at for your final paper. One that's, this is 52 seconds long, but like it's so, there's a lot going on. Yeah.
I was with a mention while I was gone, but one other thing that is creepy about having that TV in the background.
Yeah.
It's just that you wonder whether he can see inside of his twin brother's eyes.
Yeah.
You wonder whether that's looking, he like knows what's going on behind him because they are really totally seeing through each other's eyes. It's really creepy.
Yeah, in fact, we talked a little bit about, while you stepped out for a second, about the fact there feels like a way in which one person inside the room and the other person inside the observation gallery are somehow the same, you know, and so we're privy to something. But I like your idea of what the one brother's eyes are seeing through the microscope are also what's being provided on the television screen, which is to say that kind of clinical gaze that we're provided access to is very explicit in this moment, such that Foucault's notion of the clinical gaze is to say that doctors and clinicians, especially those who've had anatomy and training, have a special way of looking at you that renders them more powerful and the potential to render more invasive the way that they can pathologize, diagnose, and scrutinize your body, which is sort of is what's inherent in them. And therefore, what video technology can provide for us, this is what Lisa Cartwright talks a lot about, is it allows us the possibility to actually see what would have otherwise been very privileged down the barrels of the microscope, or in an autopsy, or during a surgery, so to speak, wouldn't have allowed us to be in that room. Cinema can actually enhance that. In this scene, it is the surgical ward, the theater space, and the more recent technology, sort of laparoscopic, sort of like telescopic, sort of like surgery, that allows us to consider and see more so what it's like to endow that particular clinical gaze. So the tensions that are at work in allowing us, by just having us sympathize with a clinician as a figure, look through their eyes in the film, in this particular moment are rendered very literal in what are the actual stakes of what Foucault talks about. What is it to look down a microscope? What is it to be in the surgery? What is it to pathologize? What is it to hear the thoughts in the head of the physician as he's looking at something, and what does that feel like? Being in the audience, watching this film, or being one of those people in that surgical ward is to have access to that particular moment. And it's an uncomfortable place to be, given the fact that, not that it's bad to have those thoughts, but given who these doctors are in this film, we feel it being given access to all of that privilege and power that they have as clinicians. Is that creepy? Are we now sort of part of that sort of like grotesque knowledge in some strange way? There's a sort of strange tutorial sort of happening in this moment, and it's one that is, it lingers afterwards, I think, in the scenes that we see that follows. Let's look at a couple more scenes. How about this one? This one is probably right up there with the one with the sex scene and the medical tools. Let's see. This is the one where the brother has a dream.
symbolism. Okay.
I'm not usually a big symbolism fan, but let's talk about what's happening in that scene. What does that all mean? Because this is a moment where, through the agent of a dream, we have now rendered into a psychoanalytic sort of gaze here to some way. You know, so what is it to sort of read this dream this particular way? If we're putting on our psychoanalytic sort of hat here, what does that little dream sequence mean?
That he's trying to separate these brothers who are psychologically and physically conjoined, really. And I don't know what she pulls out of them, but how terrifying that is.
Mm-hmm. Tastes like chicken. Yeah, I don't know. But there's definitely a sense of potentially is she a threat in some way to what their unity is. What else?
I wondered why she ate it rather than... Right? Like, rather than
a surgical instrument. Why is she trying to find one of those tools?
Yeah,
right.
Or something. I don't know.
Think. Guess. Why is she gnawing, consuming, fighting her way between them?
It's potentially devouring their identity.
Yeah, I think. I think it also is interesting in the sense that it's somebody who's not a surgeon or not a clinician that's actually, and actually through very rudimentary form, potentially dividing them, if you will. You know, the troubling narrative for every conjoined twin, going back to Chang and Aang, is do we use medical technology to intervene to separate us? Is that sort of the first question that's always asked about conjoined sort of siblings, so to speak. And to that end, there's a real way in which can medicine intervene to do this for us or not? And are we scared to have medicine intervene? And this film has, in this particular scene, a woman who is the non-medical person, who is not just separating them emotionally in some way, and not just separating their business practice and their success in some way, but their very conjointness, whatever it might be. And this dream is sort of rendering little, the fact that she's a non-clinician and she's choosing her damn teeth to do it, to be something that feels threatening to those who are surgeons and clinicians themselves. Yeah.
Well, I think cannibalism even goes a step further than that, because the imagery normally means that you accepted them into yourself. So not only has she separated them, but she has entered their private space and has actually become part of him or of them.
Yeah.
Which is disturbing. Not just the separation, but the fact that another person is in between.
Yeah.
And has assumed.
And it adds to what's sort of hard about the relationship. So close are these two brothers that to come between them is to feel like you're dividing them, what she's doing here. To come between them is to feel like you're inhabiting one of them, which is what they've done for each other in personality and in moments for each other. To come between them is to say what could normally be uncomfortable about a menage a trois is sort of exacerbated in this particular moment because of the closeness that's happening. And the ironic thing, too, is, of course, that these men have bedded women together. They've been in menage a trois. They've impersonated each other in the bed with a woman. And what happens here is that in some way, the control that they had in that circumstance is sort of changed in this particular moment. And that speaks to an unraveling, I think, that's happening in whatever strategy or control that they've had in their professional, their sexual, their fraternal, and sort of their biological lives up until this particular moment. Give me the thoughts on this little scene. I mean, again, we're back at the bed where we saw the sexual act happen before, such that the sort of separation that's happening here through devouring, the sexual act that we saw before with medical tools, and the lighting scheme that's almost the same in their office. They all are sort of conflating with one another. If you see the opening credits for this, the film, the DVD, sort of what they call it, the home menu or what have you, it tends to have two faces of Jeremy Irons separating and coming together, and one of them is this color blue, and one of them is red. Mm-hmm. And to that end, the film sometimes feels like it oscillates between those two particular templates. And I think that kind of schism, that kind of schizophrenia, if you will, almost, is inherent in, are these brothers twins, or are they schizophrenic? Together, do they make one person, or are they two different people? What's sort of happening in this particular moment? So, oscillating between those is sort of interesting. I want to jump actually much later in the film now. So what happens in between is a sort of devolution into addiction and a separation between the brothers, and we can see this in Fast Forward, and attempts to repair what is actually devolving between them. If we saw that scene of sort of like even their practice is falling apart, this is the one where he tries to do the surgery and now he's using those scary tools, right? The ones he's gotten made at an art gallery, you know, which are referred to and later exhibited in that gallery as gynecological tools for use on mutant women, is what it's called. Which is to say that those tools that we saw at the beginning are sort of reminded here. So one, and now we see the last third of the film is about the two brothers almost self-isolating. I believe the Claire Nevo character disappears entirely from Act 3. She sort of falls by away, and we just have the two brothers sort of succumbing to their own relationship. Oh, there she is briefly saying, whatever happened to you guys. Here we go. So this is our ending. It's the scene where we basically have the tools were invented to sort of repair gynecological mutant women is what it says, but actually they're now going to be used those very tools for what they're going to sort of try to do, which is to separate themselves or conjoin themselves, I think is what actually one of them wants to do, in a drug-induced sort of like stupor, if you will. So let's watch this very brief scene.
Don't forget the good part.
Part of what's troubling about the scene is the feeling of that. Is it tragic? Or was it inevitable?
I'm always most concerned about it. Darling, the pain.
So let's talk about the scene, the phrase that's invoked, in addition to the reference Chang and Aang, is you know, separation can be a terrifying thing. So we know that sort of intimacy seemed to be the terrifying thing throughout this film. Interchangeability, duplicitous sort of impersonation of one another, sharing too many professional, sexual, personal sort of things, there's no boundaries there, that the intimidation at the end of the film is now labeled as being about the separation and really does lead to the end of the film. It's interesting in the sense that it is the narrative of the conjoined twin, which is to say, does separation liberate or does separation destroy, sort of the individual. So what happens in this scene is that we have the one brother performing on the other. We see now just afterwards what's going to happen is that he's died as a result of this. Do you remember what happens in the last sort of 2 minutes to the two brothers? The one who survives?
They do like be spooned, don't they?
Well, that's the very end. what he does first is he sort of gets dressed and he goes downstairs to call Claire, you know, and he doesn't even talk. He hangs up and he goes upstairs and, you know, kills himself, we can assume, is what's going to happen in the next scene, which is to say that the literal death of one brother made possible also sort of resulted in the other. That's a traditional sort of narrative also, too, what happens in conjoined twins. The Chang and Ang, the original Siamese twins, one of them died of natural causes at the age of, I don't know, 78 or something like that, and another one died just a day or two later in something medically unrelated. But a way in which having that kind of symbiosis your entire life, it's as though even if your body doesn't technically need this other conjoined person to survive, you feel that you can't survive without, and this film is rendering that psychologically in some particular way. One thing I love about this scene and watching the separation that happens is that it's surprisingly not gruesome. We don't see the sight of separation. We don't see, it's compared to that gnawing at the conjoined, the flesh, the band of flesh between them. This is rather tame, you know, in the sense that what we see is sort of, you know, the tools, the instruments come down as though they're frightening enough, and the situation is frightening enough. We hear some of the noise, don't we, of the crunch or whatever you want to call what's happening there. And then we're provided with the image of a sort of single sort of like stream of blood that's sort of coming through the crease or the crack in the bed of the sort of examination sort of chair or what have you, the couch or whatever. Why do you think it is represented that way? Why don't we see the separation that happens? Why do we see blood the way we do in that moment, or then later when he wipes his forehead and it's the red blood that's on his gloves?
Mm-hmm. Because it's really mental.
More yeah, which is
not a physical separation.
We're going to focus less on what's happening to the body and more what seems to be happening in the eyes and the personality between them. I like that a lot, too. It also makes me wonder, how much have we actually seen blood in this movie? Is this the first moment where we're being spared blood? It makes me think that part of the reason those scrubs are red then would be that it would be unbelievable to watch a surgery mid-session happening, and there not to be some red somewhere. But to have them all red is to forgive the fact that we never actually get to see any blood at the same time. We take the theatricality of the moment for it. And that denial of seeing blood throughout the film, you know, makes the presence of it ever so minor at the end, I think, actually have greater weight. I mean, I think the only chances we see blood beforehand are on the television prompter in that surgical scene, so to speak, in that moment when she chews at him, and it's not really bloody, since we know it's some strange fantasy and fake, sort of like in the shadow sort of dream that's happening there, that our real sort of witness of a bloody moment here is not as bloody as it could be, and perhaps maybe the moment when we actually finally do see some blood in this film. Which is to say, this film is like a Cronenberg one that has the reputation of being gory and horrific, when if you actually look at it and take inventory of it, of some of those things that might constitute horrificness or goriness, they're barely there at all, you know? And yet we walk away feeling like we've been around them the entire film, which is so significant. Let's look lastly at this scene that you just mentioned, Chelsea, about they're spooning each other. Let's see here. It's the last shot of the film. And, ooh, I just want to sort of linger on why that's our last shot. Let's see here. I'll play from here and then pause. So like I said, he goes downstairs to make a phone call. Changes his mind. We basically have him waking up, the brother who did survive, realizing that he's mutilated his brother in his own sort of like drug-induced phase. He decides to leave, get dressed, go downstairs to call Claire, backs out, and instead returns to who he was partnered with before, his brother. Sort of returns there, and we can see that his probably resigned himself to die along with his brother. It's actually, if you remember the opening credits, the scene that I showed you at the very beginning of class, the two twins in utero, it's a return to that particular moment. These are twins that have been brought back together. To say they started their lives probably similarly intertwined in the same womb, being identical twins, and so they will die the same way, separation, faux surgery aside or not. The other thing I love about this scene, and it speaks a little bit to what you were talking about, Ed, in terms of the religious invocation, this is a pietà sort of representation. Does everybody know what a pietà is in art? The pietà is referred to as any work of sculpture or painting or art that represents the Virgin Mary as she's holding this Jesus Christ after he's been crucified. That moment of a mother holding her child, or of one person holding somebody else who's been executed, if you will. Particularly for Christ and mother, Christ and child is, or Christ and mother is seen as sort of like a tantamount, sort of like beautiful and tragic moment. And the construction is almost identical to what this looks like. And in fact, let me see if I can pull up. Let's see here, a Pietà image online. Oh, Lord. All right, so I'm not going to be able to pull it up because this computer's crap. All right, so, but the Pietà image, does somebody want to describe it? What it looks like?
Well, it's just that, as you said, it's very cradling the body, usually holding the entire body, classically in Michelangelo, in her arms, with the head draped, you know, obviously dead.
You've got laptops, and you pull them up on your screen and just sort of look on your partner next to you. If you pull up Pietà on Google Images and see there's like 12 that might come up, you're going to see that this is a classic sort of structure, almost choreographed, yeah.
And the other thing, of course, that makes this similar, I think, to it is the amount of cloth.
Yeah.
You know, you've got a largely naked figure in the dead Christ, a somewhat more clothed figure in Mary, but still loosely, you know, clothed for, you know, a warm climate.
Yeah.
And it's similar here with the robing.
Well, and it looks like crucifixion garb, if we know what Jesus looks like on the cross. And the fact of the matter is, for me, it harkens back to that we've been seeing images like this the whole film. That sexual scene being tied up on the bed with arms outstretched in that particular way. When we see them in the surgical ward, one of them comes forward in this sort of stance. And one of the brothers is on a surgical table, and he's sort of being brought up. We see him come up as well with the arms outstretched in a certain way. And I'm not trying to suggest that there's a Christ-like implication to this, but the stakes with which this feels like a kind of sort of like tragedy seems to me to have all of these religious invocations attached to it, in the sense that what it's doing with, it's manipulating with, is the choreography of what we see as sympathetic portraits of tragic death and martyrdom here being tapped onto or played onto or played out in some way on what has been a grotesque sort of story for us. So there is something tender in this shot, and there is something reminiscent of it being reverent or sacred in how we've seen it in Western art before, but we know that the entire film has been troubling us in ways that the reverent usually doesn't. And I think it's the stakes with which this film plays with the grotesque, the seriousness, the aesthetic beauty, and the way that it almost iconographically wants to sort of tear apart what we think of as traditionally justifiable in the representations of tragedy that we see is part of what's creepy about it, you know? Yeah.
Yeah, I think the face as well, the dead brother, has the peaceful look, thinking of the Michelangelo statue.
Yeah.
And the nape of the neck, and the way the neck is kind of straddled down towards the floor.
I mean, it's yeah, there's a lot that's happening here. It's not just the way the bodies are arranged. I mean, the sentiment, if we just saw this picture and didn't know the movie, I mean, I think we would feel a bit sort of like, oh, there's plenty of other moments where we'd see a still from this movie and be like, what the hell? Think about if somebody came in right now who just wanted to use this room. If they came in now, they would have a very different sense about the film that we've been talking about the last hour than if they came in, I don't know, 5 minutes ago when someone was gnawing on somebody's like brother who was attached to them, or having sex with medical instruments, or doing surgery in red robes and shit, you know? But it's an interesting choice to end the film on a sense of placation almost here at the end, in a way that feels jarring. Jarring, not because it's the most gruesome and gory thing, but to end on something that's almost lovely feels troubling for us after a movie with this much untroubling before it. Let's stop there. And what I want to do is just talk briefly about a couple of the articles that I have, because it's really going to segue to what I want next week's class to be about. Unless anybody has any more questions about Dead Ringers. Okay. Did everybody get a chance to see a Pietà image on a neighbor's computer or something? Yeah, you know what I'm talking about if you take a look at it. So, two articles I want you to pull out, and we're going to talk like 10 minutes about them. The first is the one that's called Bioethics at the Movies. And the second is The Visible Woman, which is by Paula Treichler, Lisa Cartwright, and Constance Henley. So let's start with Bioethics at the Movies. This is the one that's an introduction to that book, Bioethics at the Movies. What I want to do is just look at a couple of moments and see what this sort of article is sort of asking. Does everybody mind if I turn the lights on? Is that all right? Is that too bright? What's up with that? So basically, this is a book that I wanted you to read because largely there's only like two books that are out there that talk about bioethics in film. And I want you cold or?
Yeah, I think
it's okay. Okay. Yeah. So, but I want you to get a sense about what some of the prose that is out there about bioethics in film. And this is sort of the first book that sort of came out related to the topic. You turn on page 3, 4, and 5. I just kind of want to direct you towards what are the sort of basic sentiments in this book about what is it to think about bringing cinema to bioethics, what's the value of doing that work, and what are the concerns to have. So there's basically two main sections to this introductory article. The first is what's the methodology behind wedding bioethics and cinema, and the second are what is the caveats we're supposed to have. So let's start with the methodology. This is on page 3. The bottom of page 3 in the end of the first sentence states that in this volume, the endeavor to present bioethics through film by showing how an emotional engagement with the film's characters yields a kind of moral knowledge indispensable for sound practical reasoning. So it's this idea that cinema can be a useful thing for us in doing bioethics because it can allow us to add something more humane, have feeling for what we're seeing. Sometimes it's the argument that's used for why we use literature in bioethics or narrative, because it gives a sense of humanity to sort of the bioethical things we have to deal with. And that's certainly a fair place to start, but it's step one of about 50 different things that any kind of narrative or film could do for us. But that's the first point that's made here. On page 4 to 5 is the three functions that it's laid out for by in this book. One is pedagogical, you notice in the bottom of page 4, which is, say, as a teaching tool. Two is interpretively, as providing fleshed-out interpretations of independently made bioethical claims. So in other words, films allow us to see in action the theories that we talk about in bioethics. And three, experimentally, providing rich thought experiments. So there's basically three values outlined here for bioethics and film. The first is the fact that it teaches. To watch a film, they can be very helpful as teaching tools, is the point. So cinema can help us in how we teach bioethics to people. Secondly, and to be frank with you, people who watch film in bioethics departments here and throughout the world, 99% of the time, they're watching the film to do a sort of like, let's look at a film that plays out the sort of theme that we're looking at. This class is very different in the sense that we're saying, let's start with film and see where that takes us to bioethics rather than the other way around. So pedagogically. Secondly is interpretively. So film provides a way for us to see in a story or in a narrative or in a moment some concept that we've been talking about theoretically in bioethics. And again, third, experimentally. Films can sometimes put forward scenarios that make great case studies, is basically what it's saying. What would you do if you were in that particular moment? Those are three very admirable and certainly fine reasons with which film can help us understand their relevance to bioethics in the sense that they can be tools or helpful things. Which is to say that at the bottom of page at 5, the paragraph, the last full paragraph, it states, ultimately, however, we should see film's greatest role in the philosophical enterprise as pedagogical, as a complement to writings by philosophers. Which is to say that cinema, according to this book, has its greatest value in the way that it helps explain other more important things to talk about, as a supplement, if you will. I make no bones in telling you that the work that I do, my expertise as a scholar, is that 99% of people who do history of medicine in film tend to say, how can film help support the work we're already doing in history of medicine? And my work in history of medicine is saying, how is cinema actually in the history of medicine? How does it actually affect it? How is it actually a significant player in it? Not just something that would be fun to show my students once a semester. This book, and you can clearly tell that I'm leading towards, I don't like this book, is moving towards trying to think about how is film supplementary? And here's the part that bothers me. If you look on page 8 and 9, it bothers me on the one hand because I find this to be just kind of the traditional standard way people have always used film in every discipline. If you want to look at history, if you want to look at English, if you want to look at sociology, anthropology, in the earliest years they were using film, they always said the best way to use it is it's a great thing to use with students in the classroom. Sometimes it's actually kind of fun because it provides examples for discussion, that sort of thing. And it's such a lazy, I think, and doesn't take seriously how significant cinema sort of functions and works for us, and the visual arts do in some particular way. So it's a new argument because bioethics is new to cinema, but it's the same one every other discipline was making 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago, if you will, decided that bioethics, that a discipline needs cinema just to provide examples. And it's the caveats that are provided in this article that really are the ones that actually I think are revealing what are the true things that cinema offers to bioethics. This is the bottom of page 8. Very, very bottom. And there's three comments that are provided. One danger is that motion pictures, like all kinds of fiction, may persuade through mere rhetoric and emotional manipulation rather than through good reasons. So there's always an emphasis and a desire on the part of bioethicists to want to know that it is reason and logic, not rhetoric, that persuades the arguments that they do. And one must always remind oneself to beware of that. But the thought that we are ever devoid of rhetoric or of style or of emotional investment in the decisions we make, even those bioethically, is horseshit. It is ridiculous. Because the fact of the matter is, of course we need to think logic, ethics, moral reasoning when we come to a bioethical moment, but we also have to think heart, experience, life. So what cinema does is not make possible the kind of mere fiction or rhetoric that is here, but only render more prominent that which is at a stake in a dilemma, and all bioethics counters all the time. So for me, this sort of caveat here speaks less to what cinema could do to hurt bioethics than what cinema could do to reveal what is potentially hurtful in all bioethics anyway. So that's one caveat I have a problem with. Second is the number two one. Another way in which film might mislead an audience is that cinematic works, like any other narrative creation, are the products of human beings who select shots, juxtaposed images, and frame a problematic scenario. In other words, cinema feels manipulative because it's strategic in the way that it chooses shots and angles and styles. Well, I'm a literary scholar, so I can tell you this also. I can pull up any bioethical text and read it as a text and see that there's a strategy there too. Why this word and not that one? Why this paragraph at the beginning and not the end? Why did you choose to reference this particular manipulative sort of example and not this other one? What cinema provides for us, as all the arts do then, is a way in which all texts are manipulative and have particular rhetoric behind them. So the hesitation towards cinema here rings to me of self-worry about what bioethics in general has to deal with and struggle with. What film could actually provide for us then is not the disillusion or the worsening of the job of the bioethicist, but the reminder of how hard in every text we do, in every discussion we have, there's the tendency to be worried that we're not thinking in a way that we think is most advantageous. So film isn't guilty of this in any way that any other particular text is. And third, this is their third point here, another cluster of dangers in teaching and doing bioethics through the film falls under the rubric of what might be termed Philistinism. First, there is the danger that in mining film for its ethical importance, an author might fail to respect the film as an aesthetic object, as a work of cinematic art. A considerable debate rages on the relationship between art and morality, and then the next two sentences down. That said, most contemporary aestheticians would agree that moral considerations may play some role in evaluating works of cinematic art, but that one illegitimately treats an aesthetic product as mere propaganda if one evaluates it solely in this particular light. Which is to say that there's always a struggle in looking at a film, or work of art, or work of poetry, or any kind of cultural sort of text, that one is wary not to judge it based on its ethical grounds. Oscar Wilde and the sort of like hedonistic art movement of the late 19th and early 20th centuries were very famous for the fact that they basically said, and Oscar Wilde put it this way, there is no such thing as moral and immoral art, only good and bad art. Which is to say that we shouldn't be judging art or artworks on whether they're pornographic or licentious or in some way bad or right or wrong things, but the fact that they are actually good or beautiful or interesting or smart or savvy sort of texts. And it's that history that brings to the trouble of looking at literature and film. The hard part isn't rendering bioethics with film, but rendering ethics of any kind with film. If there's a hesitation on the part of literary and cinematic scholars to want to think of what is the moral questions that speak to, or the ethical questions that speak to my appreciation of this aesthetic text, it shows that there's essentially reciprocity here of hesitation. As bioethicists are wary to work with cinema because it kind of reveals some of the flaws and caveats in their own profession, literary scholars and cinematic scholars were reluctant to think bioethically or ethically about their art because they don't want to fall into the trap of thinking that art is something that has to be judged. After all, art is something that's judged on grounds of moral and immoral and good and bad. We're right at the NEA then with all of those places on funding and questions if this art is pornographic and censorship and so on. So a lot of people who study film literature just don't want ethics or morals anywhere near artwork. My problem is that the difficulty, the caveats in taking those two sides together to talk about film shouldn't forestall us or preventing us from doing that work at all. And therefore, to think about how cinema speaks with ethics or morals is absolutely a dangerous, potentially pitfall-fraught sort of like ground to be on. But great, now let's go there, you know? Let's not go there entirely because of those worries that we have. I find it difficult, too, as well, in the sense that this is what I argue as a historian, that cinema is also important because it, too, is its own form of testimony and its own form of artifact, if you will. To think about film as just an entertainment or fictional sort of fluff that's talked about here, or just a teaching tool, if you will, a supplement, is to not take seriously the way in which cinema actually has great power and the way that it helps us understand and appreciate and, at the very least, have expectations of what we expect in a clinical sort of encounter. So to that end, it's not a supplement in terms of clinical discourse. It's a player. It's a part of what's happening, and therefore we are responsible, if not smarter, to take seriously that it's a player and a part of that particular discourse. If you will, then, turn briefly to this article, The Visible Woman. It's basically this anthology by Paula Treichler and Lisa Cartwright, and it's about sort of what is to think about visual imagery in connection to women is what it's talking about, women's bodies. I had thus read it in preparation for talk to her. But I think it actually speaks to this question that I'm just mentioning here about bioethics and film more generally. The bottom of page 2, and this, like lots of Lisa Cartwright's work, as you know from hearing her talk or reading stuff in this class, is about if visual representations and visual technologies are sort of a standard and an important tool in how medicine and science functions and legitimates itself in the 20th century, then by God, other forms of visual innovative technology like that need to be a part of the cultural discussions we have about medicine. It sort of can't have it one without the other. Such, she states at the bottom of page 2, or the authors do, in the last part of the full paragraph that's on that page, about 7 lines from the bottom of that paragraph. Even if we cannot name the parts of the virus or identify their functions, we are members of an industrialized, technologized, highly literate society. We have lived our lives with the knowledge that invisible microbes cause disease, that viruses are an especially troublesome category of microbe, and that scientists who study these things can show us what they look like. Well acquainted with the conventions of scientific representation these viral images embody, we recognize them as what viruses are supposed to look like. The idea and the image have come to seem natural to us, which is to say that if the medicine and the visual representation of it is something that we both expect and something that both informs how we understand our own bodies and our own health, then it goes the other way too. How images and representations about medicine outside the clinic also sort of affect and represent the way in which that practice sort of happens. Which takes us to the points that are mentioned on page 4 and 5. It's the last thing I want to mention about this article. She references the paradoxes that this book is about, and I just ask you to look at them if you have a chance. Pages 4 and 5, there's 3 of them that are mentioned. The paradoxes of imaging technologies allowing us to see things we haven't seen before versus the way in which images of medicine also ask clinicians to see things of themselves they haven't seen before. The second paradox is the visibility of gender and women's health in science studies and how that provides a responsibility. And the third is health problems of the late 20th century necessitating both through their diagnosis and through sometimes their execution the need for visual technology. But what it takes us to is sort of the last point of this piece, and it's the one I want to harp on. And if you're going to take something home from what I'm saying about this piece, it's this. Page 9, section 3. The third paradox she sort of focuses on more closely. The imaging technologies developed and popularized over the past decade or two, laparoscopic surgery, advanced x-ray technology, cinematic innovations, visual creativity and visual arts and anatomical representation, those that have sort of come about or popularized over the past decade or two are marked by continuing struggles over cultural authority and cultural inscription. Know those two words, because this is what we're talking about here. What is the cultural authority of this particular film and how I want to think about bioethics or medicine? Versus how, what is its power of cultural inscription, if you will? That article that talks about bioethics at the movies is basically trying to say, well, there's a great deal of cultural authority in some way to what's sort of happening. It doesn't necessarily have to have much cultural inscription on how we do bioethics or clinical understanding. And in the same way that there's not much for that text to inscribe on the clinic or medicine, perhaps it doesn't have much authority scientifically or bioethically, if you will. But this text is saying, what Lisa Cartwright is arguing with Paul Treichler, is that the continuing advancements in those authorities, in those inscriptions, she writes on, over who will have the authority to define the role and meaning of these technologies and determine how they will be institutionalized. Such struggles call attention to what precisely is seen and is not seen. Just as a scientific fact at once designates something that is made and something that is not made, for example, fabricated yet simultaneously certified as not fabricated, an image may at once count for what is seen and what is not seen. Which is to say this, bioethics can certainly be used to help us teach topics, and it can help us to sort of flay out facts, and cinema can be used to help us have bioethical topics and facts, and perhaps even help with debates and be a teaching tool and so on and so forth. But in truth, it's this, and this is what the work that we're talking about this semester deals with. To be an inhabitant and a citizen in the 20th century and beyond in the clinic is to know that there is power in the way that you visually inscribe and understand not just medicine, but your own body and the world. And medicine and science has helped make this possible because of the technologies that they've advanced and used and need now to do the science that they are doing. To that end, how we see and endow and view and world medicine and science in our bodies, even outside the clinic, is a part of those same stakes and responsibilities. To that end, what troubles a lot of people about cinema is that what place does it have in the clinic or the hospital or in the bioethics classroom? Bioethicists poo-poo it because they feel like, well, there are certain places where bioethical stakes and debates sort of happen. Well, according to this idea and this logic, it's very true that the power of visual representation is so endowed in science and other forms of cultural situation to see a narrative, to watch a film about health or about bioethics or about the body or about medicine is itself a bioethical dilemma. Our dilemma is not just in the subjects that are rendered on screen in Death Ringers. It's not just the way that the story that we saw in Poison made us think about other things that we know are happening in the clinic. It's that our act of actually watching a medical-related narrative on film is itself a bioethical sort of fraught tension. How are we actually betraying the way we are or aren't supposed to see bodies? How is the movie that I'm watching of Dead Ringers that's showing some sort of salacious tale actually a form of kind of disloyalty to how I'm supposed to look at what the clinician wants me to think my body looks like? Am I being complicit by buying a ticket to this particular movie or this particular topic into ways that are counterproductive to my own healthy appreciation? If I'm trying to scare the shit out of myself by going to a movie that's in a contagion sort of drama, am I actually defying my doctor who has told me, oh, you don't need to watch movies like that, they're just going to get you upset? Watching movies is being a part of bioethics. Especially if you're watching movies that are about health science and medicine. And it's not that they can just supplement the work that we do. It's that by being citizens, and in particular, 20th and 21st century citizens, where we can't escape the value, even in the clinic, of visual representations, to watch movies is right there to put up a case study that could be in a bioethics book, because it's actually asking us to confront and complicate that which is at hand before us. And it's not obvious what's the right thing to do. If bioethics is about science and medicine, and it's also about what's the right or the wrong thing to do, especially when it's hard to determine what that is. And as we can see from the caveats provided by the different authors, movies certainly provide all sorts of it's not obvious what the right or the wrong thing is to do here. So it almost makes them rich, if not the richest of kind of tools to look at. I'm going to end there. That was the end of my little speech. But think about that, and think about that, and therefore the value of the films you're writing about, to take us back to the beginning of the class, is not just the service of saying, this movie talks about an important bioethical concept. It's actually how is the film engaged in that particular discourse as well. So I'm going to end there. Thanks, everybody. There's a screening down the hall if you want to stay for The Death of Mr. Lazarescu, which starts in 15 minutes. Mm-hmm.